now turn to our program for the future.
Economy right now is extremely supporting of the president and his policy.
FBI scientists have found chemical traces consistent with a bomb or a missile on a piece of wreckage.
Police using clubs and tear gas against demonstrators.
Mother, so-and-so and a white fascist. Rick, they said you're getting some of your own medicine.
Right once, then the rest will fall behind. Tell me who's got control of your mind, your worldview. Is it the news or the movie you taking your girl to? Know what I'm saying, cause Uncle Sam got a plan. If you examine what they telling us, then you will understand what they planting in the seeds of the next generation. Feeding our children miseducation. No one knows if there's UFOs or any life on Mars, or what they doing when they up in the stars. Because I don't believe a word of what the president said. He filling our head with lies, got us hypnotized when he be speaking in cold words about crime and poverty. Drugs, welfare, prisons, guns, and robbery. It really means us. There's no excuse for the slander, but what's good for the goose is still good for the gander, see.
I don't believe Bob Marley got me cancer. 31 years ago, I would've been a panther. They killed Huey cause they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't want no computer chip in my arm. I don't want to die by a nuclear bomb. I say we all rush the Pentagon, pull out guns and grab the intercom. My first words will be, I believe man made God out of ignorance and fear. If God made man, then why the hell would he put us here? I thought he's supposed to be the all-loving, the same God who let Hitler put the Jews in the ovens. We don't fall for the regular shit. They try to feed us all this half-ass leadership, flipping position. They turn politician and shut the hell up and follow tradition. Boy, your TV screen is telling lies to your vision. Every channel got some brainwashed cop shit to watch. Running up in niggas' cribs claiming that they earned shots. It's a plot. But Buster, can you tell me who's greedier? The big corporations, the pigs, or the media? Sign of the times. Terrorism on the rise. Commercial airplanes falling out the skies like flies. Make me wonder what secrets went down with Ron Brown. Who burned the churches to the ground with no evidence found? It's not coincidence. What? It's been too many steady incidents. It could have been the Klan who put that bomb at the Olympics, but it probably was the FBI. Deep at the core, cause if they make us all panic, they could start martial law. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey cause they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. You killed Huey cause you knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is motherfucking propaganda. IRS, TNT, CBS, NBC, FBI, CIA, ATF, KKK, IRS, TNT, CBS, NBC.
A great love and a great understanding, and that we try to extend this to the general black population and also people, oppressed people all over the world. And I think that we differ from some other groups simply because we understand the system better than most groups understand the system. And with this realization, we attempted to form a strong political base based in the community with the only strength that we have, and that's the strength of a potentially destructive force if we don't get freedom.
And that was Dead Prez singing Propaganda. On Tuesday, day after tomorrow, I believe the CATCH, the Communities Advisory Committee on Homelessness, also known as the We Cover the Ass of the City Council, while they do nothing about winter shelter, homeless deaths, lack of access to bathrooms, lack of access to fountains, lack of compliance with Martin versus Boise, and meanwhile stirring up essentially vigilantes, while at the same time saying that's not what they're doing. We don't want to see vigilante activity. We just want people to call the police. You can be, it will be your vigilantes for you, although you can attempt to de-escalate by encouraging people to abandon their rights, leave public spaces, pick up their stuff, and get out of the area that you don't want them in. But if they don't do that voluntarily, just call us and we'll do the job for you. After all, we're armed and we're dangerous and we're pretty frightening, actually. That's not, of course, what is being explicitly said, but that's the implicit message of the police department's behavior generally towards homeless people. Insofar as the criminalization of sleep, the criminalization of resting in the downtown areas, the criminalization of setting up a reasonable campsite where you can keep your stuff during the day, all this has been made a crime, essentially by unilateral action by the police department, the city manager, the head of Parks and Rec, Mills, the head of the police department, Tony Elliott, the head of Parks and Rec, Martine Bernal, the city manager. Mentioned Tony Condotti, the city attorney. Next up, we have an interview with Peter Marin, Santa Barbara activist, writer, poet, and old-time guy, as you'll hear me introduce him, probably, as I begin this phone conversation from a few days ago.
I'm on the line with activist, writer, and social justice critic Peter Marin, among all kinds of other things, poet as well, for sure. And it's the January 13th on Monday afternoon. Hello, Peter.
Yes, hello.
So, I just got your latest email, Peter, which you are announcing with some gusto, a new organization forming to defend folks who are poor and in need down in Santa Barbara, as well as do other things. You want to brief us on that?
Well, we have a terrific attorney, a guy named Joe Doherty, right, who's been a public defender for the county, but has wanted for a long time to go into private practice to work for poor and indigent people, and we managed to find a good bit of funding for him so he could open up his office, and it will be open starting this week. And as you may know, what radically changes the landscape in any community is the presence of at least one, hopefully a few more, attorneys ready to protect rights by suing the city when the law enforcement folks overstep their bounds.
Hear, hear.
And that is exactly what we now have. You will remember we had it years ago in Santa Barbara with a group called the Legal Defense Center.
I do.
Which was very successful and, in fact, won the right to vote for people without a fixed address in a federal suit. But more important than that, the presence of such an attorney and the threat of lawsuits really keeps local politicians in line. We have very good relations, for instance, with the Southern California ACLU, who has kept the city on notice when their proposed policies transcend reasonable regulations and violate the rights of the poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know one of your latest concerns has been dealing with the oversized RV gambit that they're using to essentially criminalize a lot of RVs during the day. Have I got that right?
Yes, we're about to file suit against an ordinance preventing the parking of poor people's RVs, because the city, of course, has arranged its policies so that it grants permits to anybody else who has an RV of a certain size, but it's only the poor who are forced to live in their RVs who are not allowed to park in town. If you have a Sprinter van, for instance, they won't bother you. But if you live in an old RV because you're poor, they will prevent from parking on the street.
And this has a significant impact, even though there is a very limited program for RV parking at night?
The key word is very limited, because it isn't just that you can park at night. What you do is you get one space in the daytime and another space at night, though they're not in the same places. And very often they're 10 miles from one another. So you have to drive back and forth, but while you're driving, you can't stop anywhere. And when you are in the program, the rules of the program and the regulations deprive you of several constitutional rights, such as the right to have a visitor in your vehicle, or the right to have somebody else stay overnight. I mean, these are absurd, sort of infantile rules meant for God knows who, for children. But for adults who live in their vehicles, this constricts their rights past the point of tolerance.
How many folks actually do you estimate live in their vehicles in the Santa Barbara or the greater Santa Barbara area?
I don't know. Maybe there are 50. Well, if you count cars, there are countless vehicles, right? Mm-hmm. Many students live in their cars.
Mm-hmm.
Many adults live in their cars because the rents are so high. But the cars are legal on the street. It's only RVs which are illegal. So if you count RVs, I don't know, maybe 50, maybe 100, if you're counting the Goleta and Carpinteria areas.
To the north and south.
Yeah, and both those communities have oversized vehicle policies too.
And how many are allowed to park if they keep moving to day and night spaces?
Well, that's the point. The program can only accommodate about 30 vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people on a waiting list, right? Which sort of makes no sense, the whole thing. It would be possible for the city to devise simple regulations about parking in the industrial at night, right?
In the industrial zone?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or just say you can park in the street, but you can't stay in one more than 48 hours, right? There are many ways the city can control parking in a way that prevents complaints from coming from residents and yet observes the needs and rights of the poor. I want to tell you, though, you may not be aware of it, but about a month ago, the city decided to put forth for consideration two absurd ordinances, one of which would have allowed the police to confiscate shopping carts from any poor person who had a cart, and then at the same time confiscate and destroy their belongings.
Wow.
And this is just sort of insanity. And the reason the mayor wanted to do this was because she'd gotten complaints from some residents who didn't like having to look at shopping carts when they were chained to a tree or to a post in their immediate neighborhood.
Name of the mayor?
Kathy Murillo.
Okay. It's been a while since I was in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, progressive Democrat, by the way.
Of course.
And we managed to roll that back. There was a sort of hue and cry. The new attorney in town that I'm describing to you wrote a letter to them. We prevailed on the ACLU to write a letter to them. We got up and shouted at them. And, of course, what they did then was, well, they decided not to go forward with the ordinance, but they decided to arrange a big stakeholder meeting, as if well-to-do people had somehow a stake in what the poor do with their shopping carts. And now we've sat through a round of discussions about what to do about shopping carts, and in the end, they're going to let the ordinance sort of disappear, right? But not permanently. They're going to hold it in reservation in case they decide to resurrect it.
And you said this was one of two ordinances?
Yeah, the other one was an ordinance because we have a very few street encampments, right? So they wanted to pass an ordinance which allowed the police to confiscate possessions of police of street encampments with 4 hours notice. Now, you know, as I do, the traditional notice given for property confiscation is 72 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And in theory, anything less than that requires a hearing. But the city was, I mean, it was just insane because no court in America would allow you to confiscate and destroy property with 4 hours notice. 4 hours notice allows you to put up a sign when someone is away from the camp, and before they return, you can take all their property and destroy it. Our city, by the way, has a policy of automatically destroying any property worth less than $100. And of course, no surprise, when they find homeless property or take it away, they never deem it to be worth more than $100. There's nothing like a formal appraisal because the city wouldn't think that was necessary, right? So it's just a sort of craziness in which they decide to ignore all existing laws in order to overreach and treat the homeless badly. And again, this is a city council made up of 6 Democrats and 1 conservative Republican.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone been tracking the amount of property that's been taken from homeless people in the last month?
No. We don't have a system for doing that. As you know, though, as I've constantly tried to remind our city officials, Fresno had to pony up $2 million, which was their punishment for overstepping their bounds and illegally destroying homeless property they treated as junk. Right? Now, the reason, and this will come full circle, the reason you need attorneys in town is because you have to be able to threaten to sue the city on the basis of cases which have already gone to court and been settled. But if you don't have an attorney, the city can completely ignore what the law is and proceed to do what they want.
You know, the original Fresno case, the Kincaid case, actually began because Mike Rhodes and his daughter just began videoing all the seizures that were going on, or many of them, or some of them, and then just took it to 2 law firms, out-of-town law firms they were, I think, and the attorneys realized that they could
make some money.
Although I think in the end they donated at least a significant portion of the money back to the homeless folks who had lost their property. Although, ironically, of course, 10 years after that decision in 2017, the city began doing what it was doing before because the injunction ran out.
Yes. With the oversized vehicle suit, which we will soon file, the first thing we do is ask for injunctive relief. And if you get injunctive relief, this should, to some extent, discourage the city from doing what they do, because the granting of injunctive relief implies that you have a good case.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And sometimes that's enough to change a city's policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the big know, I wanted to stop doing what I do for a very long time. And with this new guy, I feel that I can, because all the city has to understand is that somebody mean is watching what they do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big thing. If they know somebody is watching and ready to take action, they become much more careful about the extent to which they're willing to violate the law.
So, the governor, as you know, has weighed in with this look for Caltrans properties, supposedly an executive directive to cities and counties and jurisdictions to find places where that are vacant areas as well as vacant buildings. Is this having any impact in Santa Barbara, do you think?
No, we haven't had that discussed at all. I mean, the one thing you have to understand, I mean, I've realized this. I tried to reorganize the Committee for Social Justice, and I got a few new people on the board, but they're very nice. They're not really active. They don't pay attention to what's going on. Many of them have full-time jobs, of course, which makes it much harder, right? And so we don't really have what you need, which is someone paying complete attention, A, to what's going on in town, and B, what's going on elsewhere, right? We just don't have that. So we rely on county and city officials to keep up with this stuff, and they don't really do it because they're busy, and to some extent this is not high on their list of priorities.
Mm-hmm. Of course, also the Supreme Court's turning down the city's attempt to overturn, although not really upholding, Martin versus Boise, the decision that said you can't arrest people if there's inadequate shelter. Has this had any impact in Santa Barbara?
Well, it's a very interesting ruling, the original ruling, because it doesn't necessarily permit camping, right? It also says the fact that you can sleep on public property doesn't mean you can necessarily sleep anywhere you want, right? So it left a certain amount of room open for interpretation.
True.
So, I mean, I think our city is grudgingly reasonable in this respect. They don't want people sleeping visibly on State Street, for instance, right?
That's the main drag in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, yeah, and you can sort of understand that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know that when it's raining, people sleep under the big arch of the courthouse, right? Which is in the city, maybe county property, but they're left alone, right? Basically, if you stay out of sight, you're left alone. Now, if you're visible, say, in a street, we don't have many people visibly sleeping on the streets, right? We don't have tent encampments. It's very interesting to me, right? I mean, because it's not a big city. And I suppose the city has a half-legitimate argument because so much of the city's economy depends on tourism, right? That's true, right? So we present ourselves as this beautiful, perfect seaside town, right? And the argument is if there's homeless people everywhere, invisible, tourists won't come. You know, it's probably 30-50% true, right? The fact is, though, that our city won't build a fucking shelter. They just won't, right? They won't even discuss it. And so the fact is they force people into the streets because of the absence of shelter and the extraordinarily high cost of housing, and then they pursue them or control them without understanding that the legitimate response to homelessness is affordable housing and or emergency shelter, right? That's what's extraordinary about us. As you know, in Los Angeles, I don't think I've seen this about San Francisco, but in Los Angeles, the city council is trying to put shelter in every councilman's district or councilwoman's district, right? We're not doing anything like that, and I suppose most small cities are not doing anything like that.
Well, you know, in Santa Cruz, which is smaller than Santa Barbara, you are seeing people with tents popping up along the highway and popping up downtown all over the place. I'm surprised that it's not happening in Santa Barbara, because it is happening here. What the police chief here has, they're using this subterfuge of all kinds of other ordinances other than camping or sleeping. Although you were, you know, you may well be right in saying that they can fudge on the camping versus sleeping stuff in the Martin versus Boise decision, but I think they're avoiding trying to use the camping ordinance at all. But instead, it's blocking the sidewalk, public nuisance, being in a park after dark.
And you can sort of slip by with that.
They are, but on the other hand, you know, they're in tent encampments that are appearing all over. They leave them alone for a couple of days, and then they seize everybody's stuff or tell them, move on, you know, you've got only a short time.
Right.
We don't have a four-hour law or a three-foot law like they do in Berkeley. And in Berkeley, they have this, you can all your possessions have to be within a radius of 3 feet, or else we can confiscate them without any notice, actually. They just can confiscate them. That's their supposed law. I don't know if they're doing it. When I was in Berkeley last couple weeks ago,
I mean, but
plenty of tents.
The fact is, we see continuously, I mean, and what you're describing is probably half the time legal and half the time not legal, and there has to be some group or somebody to keep after the police for the half the time that's not legal, right? But it's not easy to do that, right? And we have a much smaller advocacy community than we used to, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have now all service providers, if there are anybody doing anything. Do you understand?
You may be using service generously, too.
Yeah, right. I mean, and the other thing is people get jobs, right, as service providers, which pay salaries. Advocacy doesn't pay salaries to anybody, unless you're in the ACLU.
Mm-hmm.
But most advocates work for free, and unless the homeless are basically organized and advocating for themselves, which used to be the case in Santa Barbara, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not very much gets done.
In Berkeley, there's a group called, you've probably seen it on the media, Where Can We Go, which has held off the Caltrain for several months now. And, of course, then there's the First We Came for the Homeless encampment, which is, after being busted 17 times by the police and moved 17 times for the last couple of years, has been situated in one place, and the city has grudgingly allowed it, similar to Portland's Dignity Village, perhaps. Anything like that in Santa Barbara?
No. I mean, I have a question for you, though. If the government acted in relation to Caltrans, why didn't he repeat the old policy of making the armories available? You remember that. That was a smart deal.
I think they have, actually. Although, at least here in Santa Cruz, the city manager announced 3 or 4 days ago that he would be opening up the armory at least for the month and a half period until mid-March. Although that would be because they want to eliminate a campground that the city has been, an expensive campground, funding. The cost is $75,000 a month for 60 people, which they used to destroy a much larger homeless-initiated campground for several hundred people, the Ross Camp, which they destroyed in May.
Light of change, there is a virtue. across the nation, and there is wailing the whole world round. But I am open and I am willing, for to be hopeless would seem so strange, dishonest. Those who go
was Holly Near, I Am Willing, to the interview with Peter Merrim.
So apparently the armory is about to open, but only for a very limited number of people. It's mainly a place, it's going to open this time on a 24-hour basis, according to, I think, it's a little unclear, there'll be a city manager's report tomorrow at city council. Not like the old drive them up at night, drive them back at 5 in the morning stuff. This is going to be what is currently the situation in the what we call the 1220 River Street camp, which is the camp for 60 people that gets to stay there day and night and stores their stuff there. It stays during the day. It has significant advantages, obviously, over shelters, but it also has disadvantages in the sense that you don't allow you to walk in and out. It, you know, you get kind of treated like children.
Well, I mean, so here's a question. You have an immense amount of activity going on compared to anything down here.
Mm.
I mean, we have almost nothing. Nothing organized. And I wonder if, is your armory open because the governor ordered or permitted it, or is it just something local, right?
That's a good question. I think it has to, it may be a combination of the two. Maybe the governor allowed it, and one of the reasons the armory hasn't been open the last couple of years is because it's been so expensive, I believe. That's one of the concerns, although I'm not entirely clear on that one. Can't really tell you, Peter.
We have someone in the county who's supposedly their outreach homeless czarina, and I'm supposed to have lunch with her on Friday, so I can ask her, but I haven't heard much about any of this at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a huge amount of money that's been coming in, you know, from these grants. I don't know, HIP and HAP and HOOP grants.
And what we have, which is unfortunate, is we have a lot of theoretically service providers, right, who are supposed to find housing for people. So the position of our city in general is that they will take the money coming in, right, which is meant to service the homeless, and give it or to the organizations that are, in theory, providing housing, right?
Uh-huh.
Finding housing.
Right.
Or sending people back to their families. They do not use it for shelter. You understand? Uh-huh. So most of the money coming is general funding, which allows the city to use in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the general policy in this area to use it for housing, right?
Or the pretext of looking for housing.
Yeah, it's largely a pretext. I mean, mm-hmm. interestingly, the details of all this are really interesting. In Goleta, which is our neighboring city, the city council voted to make it a rule that when housing goes up, 25% of it had to be affordable housing, right? In Santa Barbara, the city council argued back and forth whether it should be 10 or 15% and eventually settled on 10%. Right? Now, that's criminal.
Mm-hmm. And how affordable is the affordable housing percentage?
I guess it's affordable, not for those on disability, right? But it's not affordable for people on disability or with incomes of less than $1,000 or $1,200 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the problems is most of our housing is above the level where Section 8 can be used. You understand? There's a limit to the amount that Section 8 vouchers can be spent for, right? Because they'll pay a certain percentage of the rent. But if the rent gets up above a certain point, they won't consider it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our apartments are above that level.
And here we have this, we were told that the Section 8 waiting list is closed and long.
Ours is 6 to 8 years long.
And so plus, of course, you get people, most people, or many landlords will not take Section 8.
Take it, but my suggestion, which I've just begun to make to the city, and it's not a bad idea for you up there, is the city or the county could augment Section 8 vouchers. You understand? If you have a voucher and go to a landlord, the city or the county could say, okay, we'll give the landlord $500 a month to accept the voucher.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Yeah, I understand.
Which would be a cheap way to get people housed. Right. But, of course, you have to convince the city or the county to do it.
Plus, there has to be, that only, again, deals with those who do have Section 8 vouchers.
Yes, I know. And then you have to have the county organization and the city organization, which are aggressive to reach out to people and offer them services rather than just waiting for them to show up.
So what legal challenges is this new group, I think you've mentioned one already, around RVs, oversized vehicles. Anything else coming that we should be alert to?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me just a minute. We have to leave it and after at the latest. Okay. Right.
Well, let me let you go, Peter.
Yeah.
You said...
Oh, so, I got a couple more minutes.
Go ahead.
No, outside of this new lawyer, right, who's going to defend rights, which, as you know, is a holding action, right? It prevents the city from doing the worst things.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come close to solving any problem, except the individual problems people have when they're hounded by the police, right? I mean, look, even Boise, which was a great decision, doesn't fix anything, right? It just means more people can stay on the streets, which is hardly a solution to the problem. I mean, what Boise was meant to do, basically, was to tell cities, you better shelter people, because if you don't shelter them, they're going to be on your streets, right?
Although it explicitly said you don't have to shelter them.
Yeah, but it said basically you don't have to shelter them, but if you don't, they're going to be everywhere, right?
That's certainly one of the implications of it, yeah.
But no one took that. I mean, in L.A., I think they did. They took it. They have a big problem. But I don't think San Francisco is trying to shelter many people, is it?
Well, they have navigation centers that don't navigate anywhere, but are kind of large tent, or I'm not sure if they're tent shelters or solid building shelters. I'm not familiar. They're not. They're better regarded than the previous shelter system, but they're not well regarded by homeless activists up there. Of course, homeless activists like RAP, Western Regional Advocacy Project, Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco, and other groups are looking for, obviously, housing, which means a massive expenditure of money from the federal government, which neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have interest in.
Because, tell me if this is wrong. I mean, my apprehension of some people on the street, have you ever seen Lowe's and Sisters in Sacramento, the shelter?
A while ago.
I think many people on the street, when we had Casa Esperanza, right?
Mm.
I think many people on the street like the shelter.
Hmm.
Do you understand?
I think some do, and some don't.
It was easier living than having your own apartment in a certain way, right? And it was social.
I don't think that's generally true in Santa Cruz, but maybe Loaves and Fishes is an exception. I'm not terribly familiar with them and haven't been in touch with the Sacramento activists.
Terrific shelter, right? A separate building with a library, handball courts, basketball courts, right? It was sort of like a resort.
Hmm.
Right? Kennels for your dog.
Did you have conversations with folks who lived there? Or?
Briefly, they had a bank. They had a clinic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everything was at your fingertips.
Well, remember that, you know, in coal mining towns, they had company stores, too,
right,
and company facilities. I don't know if that's something that necessarily...
No, one of the things that happens in my town, and it happens regularly, is people get housing and then they lose it, right?
Right.
The building is sold, right? The rents are raised, mm-hmm, right? All kinds of things can happen.
Mm-hmm. And in shelters, you're in the hands of bureaucrats who are running the shelters, so it's...
Yeah, it's also a question of how a shelter is run. I understand.
I mean, I think most shelters are not run by the people who live in them. That would be nice if they were, but...
But listen, I remember in the old days, we had guys who would get housing and then sleep on the floor, right? Men especially.
What do you mean?
Because they're not necessarily good at taking care of themselves. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Uh-huh.
Right? Cooking for yourself, doing this, doing that, keeping the house, all of this, if you're completely on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when you're basically forgotten. I mean, we've been building housing, and you must have it up there, which has a service agency involved, right?
Yeah, yeah. I remember you were praising in the old days about a decade ago single room occupancy hotels and bemoaning the loss of those hotels, and that, you know, that was necessary for people, I don't know, drunks, hobos, folks who were passing through town, casual labor, homeless folks, and it was something that, you know, they don't provide you with all those racket courts and all kinds of wonderful things, but it's a little privacy, a little decency, and a place to sleep, you know.
They did studies of Bowery hotels, and people liked living in them.
Right. That's what I'm saying. This seems to contradict what you're saying now, that, you know, you look...
What I'm saying, I think, is we have so much homelessness, right, that you can't categorize everybody.
Oh, for sure, you know. But you can say that they don't have any place to go and sleep.
You
sure
can say that, and some people want to be just left entirely alone. Right?
For sure, yeah.
But what I've seen in Santa Barbara, we have street people who get housing. They're completely on their own. they can't quite navigate the system, and something goes wrong with the landlord, and they're back on the street because nobody is protecting them.
A frequent occurrence, or?
Yes, it's frequent. Well, especially down here, because real estate is of a particular kind. Buildings change hands all the time. Rents keep going up. Property values keep going up. Buildings are traded back and forth. Everybody knows how to get around the rules, right?
But that's a function of the profiteering system, not of people, you know, not being comfortable.
Absolutely. It's capitalism, right?
Right, but it's not because people don't know how to deal with it, would prefer to be in a shelter or anything like that.
I mean, no, but the other thing is we don't have people who know about tenants' rights, right? We don't know people when the landlord does something. They don't know where to go to prevent it.
But this new organization you have will move forward and deal with that.
One guy, yeah.
Yeah, well.
One guy.
One guy supported by a bunch of other guys, though, it sounds like.
Maybe, but you know, we don't have pro bono attorneys in town anymore.
Maybe some student interns, perhaps?
He's going to use Joe. His name is Joe Doherty. He's going to use student interns. Let me tell you, this is a horrible town. You know, you can go to court to get your past records expunged, right? If they're juvenile records or if you've lived a nice life, right, since things are on your record. We have a DA in town who fights every attempt to expunge records.
Oh, boy.
Right?
Yeah.
Who will go to court to fight the expungement of anybody's record.
Interesting.
I mean, it's just horrific.
What's his name?
Joy, this is a female, Joyce Dudley, I think.
Well, get rid of her.
I think of it in terms of interns, because Joe Doherty is going to have to get interns, because he can't keep going to court every day to get a record expunged.
I guess Glenn Maurer is helping with this at all, or?
No, Glenn...
He's the former head of the Public Defender's Office.
No, Glenn vetted Joe, right?
Uh-huh.
So did Joe Allen for us. We raised a lot of money for Joe. We raised $30,000.
Uh-huh.
And $10,000 of it was our own, right? But I had him, of course, checked out by Glenn and Joe Allen, and they both liked the guy and said, yeah, let's do it, right? And then I think Glenn made him a contribution to him out of his own pocket. And the Committee for Social Justice has a little legal team or an advisory team, and Joe Doherty is a part of it, and so are a couple other people like Joe Allen. So we sort of work together with Joe, but in point of fact, he remains... Everybody else gave up their law. Glenn doesn't have a law license anymore. Joe Allen doesn't have a law license, right?
And Will Hastings has disappeared, or?
He died.
Oh, he did die. Okay. When was that?
Oh, I don't know. I believe he died. No, he doesn't practice. I mean, the weird thing is, and I understand, because keeping your license intact takes money and stuff, right?
Huh.
I think people like to... make sure in their minds they're retired by giving up the license, or else you're always subject to someone's request to help out.
Huh.
So all the old guys are gone, which is, I mean, that's why we jumped at the chance to help Joe Doherty, because he's the only one who's come along in a very long time.
Joe's a younger guy, or?
He's younger. He's a young, Irish guy, probably from a working class family.
Uh-huh.
You know, even when we sued the cities about the oversized vehicles, we had to hire an attorney, sort of at a cut rate, but we didn't get any free legal work. And as you know, legal work is expensive unless someone agrees to do it for free. Right. I got to go. I got to take my wife to the hearing doctor.
Do it. And thank you for taking the time, Peter.
Yeah, I'm sorry it couldn't be longer, right? I'm not gloomy about any of this, but I'm sort of overwhelmed by the...
Well, you sound less gloomy than the last time we talked.
To live in a Democrat town, right? A town run by Democrats and by the Democratic political club and have to do all this crap is just astonishing to me.
Yeah, well, remember...
These are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, I don't have a lot of confidence in them either, but...
Nor I.
Right, right.
But why these people are intentionally... And it's not just the homeless, it's the working poor, right? It's a bigger issue than that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Wright County, Santa Barbara County, has, according to the Public Policy Institute, 26% of adults and children live in poverty.
I think we got a bigger percentage, but we won't. I'm not going to argue about that one.
No. And we're right behind Los Angeles and Santa Cruz County. That's right.
There you go.
Yep.
Well, listen, we'll talk again.
Yeah, all right. Sure. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I was born into this world. This is what happened to me. I was never called a man, and now I'm 53. I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when will I get to be called a man, or do I have to wait till I get 93? When Uncle Sam called me, I knowed I'd be called a real McCoy. But it wasn't no different. They just called me Soldier Boy. I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when. I wonder when will I get to be called a man, or do I have to wait till I get 93? When I got back from overseas, that night we had a ball. But I met the boss the very next day, and he get you some overhauls. I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when. I wonder when will I get to be called a man, or do I have to wait till I get 93? I worked on farms, levy camps, and extra gang too. But a black man's a boy, I don't care what he can do. I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when. Wonder when will I get to be called a man, or do I have to wait till I get 93? I was called a plowboy on a farm and a soldier boy in Camp Hill. Now I'm just old and gray, and they just calls me Uncle Bill. I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when. I wonder when will I get to be called a man, or do I have to wait till I get 93? They said I was uneducated, my clothes was worn torn. Now I've got a little education, but I'm a boy right on. I wonder when. Yes, I wonder when. Wonder when will I get to be called a man, or do I have to wait till I get 93?
It was Big Bill Brunzi from his 1955 London Sessions album, When Do I Get to Be Called a Man? Well, let's take a peek in the newspaper. Here's a story from January 6th, San Francisco Chronicle. Cop's fatal shot tests new DA's promises. Boudin has pledged to hold police more accountable. When Chesa Boudin was sworn in this week as San Francisco's district attorney, one of his responsibilities will be deciding whether to charge officers in a handful of police shooting investigations that were left unresolved by his predecessor, George Gascon.
Of the five cases Boudin will review when he takes office, one stands out the most: the 2017 fatal shooting of Keta O'Neill by rookie officer Chris Samayoa, who had just graduated from a police academy and was on the fourth day of a 16-week field training program. The case is being closely watched by legal observers and advocates as a possible test case for the new district attorney, who campaigned on holding law enforcement more accountable. Unlike the other unresolved police shootings in which suspects had allegedly shot at or attacked officers, O'Neill, 42, was unarmed and apparently fleeing when Samayoa fatally shot him in the head during a police chase through the Alice Griffith public housing complex. Chief Bill Scott fired Samayoa weeks after the shooting, signaling he believed the shooting was wrongful. Representatives for O'Neill's family and police watchdogs called the case low-hanging fruit, saying it is a chance for Boudin to make good on his campaign pledge to be tougher on cops. But some police groups and advocates, like the City Police Union, said Samayoa was, quote, doing what he was trained to do, unquote. His dismissal was unwarranted, they said, and criminal charges would be even more unreasonable. One thing I'm committed to doing is enforcing the law equally, Boudin said in a recent interview with the Chronicle. He declined to comment on any open matters, saying he had not been briefed on the cases and commenting he would risk interfering with investigations. In general, though, he said his goal as district attorney, quote, is to take whatever step is necessary to rebuild trust between law enforcement and communities that law enforcement protect. Oh, dear. Watch out for that. He also promised to resolve investigations into police more quickly. Boudin was more pointed on the campaign trail, saying the city needs to be very, very serious about officers who don't follow the rules. He was also the only candidate in the race to say he would have charged officers in one of San Francisco's most incendiary police killings, the 2015 shooting of Mario Woods in the Bayview. Gascon cleared the five officers who fired 26 rounds at Woods in a shooting that was captured on video and prompted sweeping reforms in the department. The former district attorney cited insufficient evidence to prove the officers acted unreasonably in defending themselves and others, spurring outrage from some activist groups. The fatal shooting of O'Neill also caused an uproar in San Francisco. It happened at the end of a police chase on December 1, 2017. O'Neill allegedly grabbed the keys from a state lottery worker on Potrero Hill, pushed her to the ground, and drove off in her white minivan. Officers intercepted the van on Highway 101 in the Bayview and chased it into the Alice Griffith public housing complex two blocks away, where O'Neill got out and ran toward a pursuing patrol car. Behind the wheel of the police cruiser was Officer Edric Taliesin, a field training officer who was instructing Samayoa. Police released body camera footage from Samayoa's chest shortly after the shooting that showed the officer drawing his pistol from the passenger's seat as the cruiser was still moving. A second later, Samayoa opened the side door and fired a single shot through the window, hitting O'Neill in the head as he ran beside the car. Police said O'Neill was unarmed. Neither officer had activated his body-worn camera before the shooting, an apparent violation of department policy. But Samayoa turned his on immediately afterward, allowing the 30 seconds before the device was turned on, known as buffering mode, to be recorded without sound. Before becoming a cop, Samayoa had graduated from the Riordan High in 2008 and earned a master's degree at the University of San Francisco in counseling and psychology. He later got a job counseling homeless families at Edgewood Center in San Francisco. 3 months after the shooting, the chief fired Samayoa, who was on a probationary period and could be let go without showing cause. Scott didn't explain why he fired the officer. It would be egregious not to have prosecution, said Melissa Nold, an attorney representing O'Neill's mother in a wrongful death lawsuit against the two officers and the city. This is low-hanging fruit and easy for the district attorney. The officer was fired. She added that if there's not going to be prosecution on this case, it's really a bad statement on what the district attorney's future is going to be like. But Tony Montoya, president of the San Francisco Police Officers Association, watch out, defended Samayoa. Even though the officer was fired, the union said it will still provide him with an attorney if he's charged. Samayoa's attorney did not respond to a request for comment. Based on the totality of circumstances and based on his training and experience, Chris reasonably responded. Chris reasonably responded, Montioa said. Even if it was an experienced officer, I think you would have had the same results. Montoya pointed out that the shooting happened in a split second and Samayoa probably didn't have time to see that O'Neill didn't have a weapon. From our experience, people fleeing the police usually run away from the police. But in this circumstance, O'Neill ran toward the officers, he said. In my mind, this guy could be coming to attack or ambush or whatever. What Samayoa was thinking at the time and what he told investigators will probably be a crucial piece of evidence. But because the officers didn't activate their body cameras, investigators don't have a recording of what was said in the patrol car. Stepping away from the story for a moment, I'm a little confused about what the policy is for this buffering mode for these recording devices that police are wearing. If it gets turned on and you get then 30 seconds before recorded without sound, which is what this article says, what is it, a time machine? How can it go back unless it's been recording for a long time before it's turned on? Because how can it suddenly jump back to record what has previously happened if it wasn't turned on at that point? I don't understand, but let's go on anyway. The police use of force at the time, established by a pair of U.S. Supreme Court cases, considers whether a, quote, reasonable officer in similar circumstances would have acted the same way. The law does not consider what an officer may learn in hindsight. It happens so fast that it's impossible to ascertain what's going on and what this officer reasonably perceived. No one can see it, said Obayashi, an attorney and Plumas County Sheriff's deputy who is an instructor on use of force investigations. The officers could have reasonably believed he was going to attack them, he said. Obviously, he committed a violent felony, and now suddenly he's running toward the officers. There's not a lot of time to think under those circumstances. Just because he's not armed is not a factor to determine whether the use of force was justified. I think I can agree with that one. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom signed AB 392 after controversial police killings of people of color. The new law, which took effect January 1st, directs police to use deadly force only, quote, when necessary in defense of human life and when possible to use techniques to de-escalate a confrontation before shooting. The law does not define, quote, necessary, and many attorneys and law enforcement groups have debated whether it actually changes the state's use of force standard. But either way, the law cannot be applied retroactively, so prosecutors must consider cases like O'Neill's under the previous standard. Boudin must review four other officer-involved shootings when he takes office: the January 2017 non-fatal shooting of Sean Moore, who fought with police on the steps outside his front door in the city's Ocean View department; the March 2018 police killing of Jesus Delgado Duarte, an armed robbery suspect who was shot in the trunk of a car in the city's Mission District after he fired first on police; the September shooting by sheriff's deputies that killed a dog and left David Wesser with a hand injury in his Polk Gulch apartment; and the non-fatal shooting last month of Jamaica Hampton, who allegedly attacked an officer with a bottle and was shot as he ran towards another officer in the Mission District. Officer killed, killing of unarmed man to test new DA is the name of the story. It's by Ivan Cernovsky, and it's in the January 6th San Francisco Chronicle.
So I'm down here at the sidewalk side of George and Daniel, and it's, what is this building you guys are next to? The
post office?
Still the post office. And it's, boy, it's, the post office extends most of the way down this block. And we're talking with?
George Willoughby.
And George, I've talked to you a number of occasions. Remember at the Ross camp when they bounced everybody out of there, sickeningly enough. And it looks like you guys are nestled in for the night along the sidewalk, although not blocking the sidewalk.
And George Willoughby, the fellow who just introduced himself, was a guy in a wheelchair who had been living at the Desiree Quintero Memorial Survival Camp, also known as Camp Phoenix, on the old Ross Camp site in November when police, without really much warning, moved in and demanded everyone leave, claiming they were trespassing after for the previous 5 days, saying that they couldn't move in because they weren't trespassing. So they also promised George Willoughby a place to go and gave him nothing. Here's more. He's now, of course, or when I was interviewing him, he was right outside the fence at the post office area, or along the long block that joins the post office. The fence recently, or I should say a year or two ago, put up to discourage homeless people from being there, or to protect the post office building, or to, I'm not sure why the hell the fence was put up, except it seems of a piece with a fence put up at Loudon Nelson Park, Laurel Park, which is locked at night and supposedly keeps out people, though people can hop the fence whenever they want. It's pretty silly stuff, and pretty nasty, and kind of apartheid segregationist kind of stuff, which is a piece with Loudon Nelson's supervisor, Izeth Ray's exclusion of the community from its bathrooms unless they are in a program, so as to exclude homeless people, which is what it was originally done to do, even though she denies that. That's my belief.
There's passageway through. People in a wheelchair could get through. You're right next to the mailbox in case you want to mail a letter. Payphone is a ways up. It's up at Front Street. That's where it's kind of a long walk. But, and the nearest porta potty is, what, 2 blocks away or something? That's a ways away, that, you know. So I guess there's hopefully a place to piss somewhere. Everybody, you got your own, you know, vessel for taking care of those issues. That's good. Any hassles or problems with the police, Daniel?
No, not with me.
Do they come by at all or not?
They haven't for quite a while, but they have in the past.
And how long have you been here?
We've been here a couple of years.
And how long have you been at this spot?
A couple of years.
At this
on
spot?
On and on.
But most recently, how long?
Three months.
Really? At this, right here, or like along
right
this
here,
area?
This spot.
Wow. And then what about George here? George?
We are camped.
You guys camp together. Rangers, how are they treating you?
They actually treated us well.
That's good.
Yeah, they do treat us well.
And,
I don't know, anything
they
want?
They know George is a veteran, and that he's 77, and they give him respect, which is nice of them.
And they respect you as a sort of a companion, caretaker,
yes,
friend, that sort of thing?
Yes, they do.
Well, that sounds good.
Yes.
How about the local businesses? How are they responding to all this?
They're fine with us. We haven't had any problems. So, none to speak of.
That's good.
George, you're saying?
I sell leather products on the street. I make my medicine bags and my wallets and stuff like that. I'm down the street by the Pacific Avenue every day. George Willoughby. George's leather shop.
I caught some of that, George. I'm gonna leave it at that. Is it okay if I play this on the internet?
Absolutely.
Okay, George.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. All right. Thank you. I'm out of here, and I will.
Thank you, sir. You have a fabulous night.
Back and forth. You too.
Appreciate
man.
What you do.
You too. Sleep tight.
Yeah.